Accessibility Craft Podcast, where we explore the art of creating accessible websites while trying out interesting craft beverages. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Equalize Digital, a WordPress accessibility company and the proud creators of the Accessibility Checker plugin. And now, on to the show.
Hey everybody, it's Amber, and I'm here today with Chris.
Hey everybody.
And we have a special guest, our friend Carl Groves here. Hi, Carl.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. We are so excited to have you join us on the podcast and share what you are working on. But I'm wondering if you want to start by just giving a brief introduction to yourself for anyone who hasn't met you before.
Sure. So I'm Carl Groves, accessibility consultant, web developer, serial entrepreneur for whatever that's worth, and founder of multiple software companies.
Awesome. Well, we are so excited to have you here today. For everyone who is tuning in, this is episode number 146. And if you are interested in show notes or a full transcript, you can find that if you go to accessibilitycraft.com/146. Of course, we start every episode with a beverage. What are we drinking today, Chris?
So, Carl, you said you like European German beers. I'm going to try not to butcher this. It's got a fun name, but according to my research, and this is coming from someone who took German in high school and college, and I'm still struggling with this, it's called Echt Schlenkerle Rauchbier, but it's from a super old brewery, is my understanding, and it's from Bavaria. And apparently they use this really old school malting process that it makes the beer taste kind of smoky. So I've never had this before personally. Have you had it before? It's okay if you have, but.
Yes, this is going to be really fun. I don't want to spoil anything, but yes, this is, I have had this before.
I have never had this one before. And I will admit when I saw that smoke beer, I was a little bit like, huh, I don't know if I'm going to like this or not.
Yeah.
Is it going to taste like barbecue, Carl?
So here's the thing. When we were talking, I did mention that I like Märzen, right? And so Märzen in German, it means it's brewed in March. That's where that comes from. But the smoke beer part is actually not one of my favorites. So it's been a long time.
Oh, no. Okay. Sorry.
I have a backup, but I figured, you know what? I'm going to be open-minded. It's been a long time since I've had it, and I don't want to spoil anything for you guys, but let's dive in, I guess.
Yeah, let's dive in. So I'm going to crack this open. I've got a glass for it and everything.
Same here.
I'll try to get it.
These are not twists off, huh?
No.
It's always fun to watch the pours. This is darker than I thought it was going to be. It's hard to tell because it's in a really dark brown glass bottle, so you can't really see the color of the beer. And it's got a very kind of old school German looking label that looks like it's, I don't know, parchment paper with a seal on it. Maybe would be how I would describe that for people listening.
Now, what's interesting too is, you know, the writing at the top of the label is pretty difficult to read anyway. But I can.
Do you speak German?
Nicht
can
gut.
You read that?
Nicht gut. Yeah, not very well. I don't speak. So it says Dem Bayerischeri. So it's from Bavaria. And it says the next word is Reinheitsgebot. Reinheitsgebot is a German, old German beer purity law that basically said that the only thing that you could have in your beer is water, hops, and barley, water, hops, yeast, and barley, right? So you couldn't have any additives in your beer. And so it has to have water, hops, yeast, and barley, which makes it interesting. I don't know how they get the smoke flavor in it. I mean, I guess they don't count smoke as a flavor.
According to what I read about this, they apparently take the barley malt and they kiln it over a fire with beechwood logs. And that's where the flavor comes from. I haven't tasted this yet, but it smells old. like it's from an old brewery. Like it's got that molasses-y kind of
compliment.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a compliment either, to be clear.
Oh, I was just going to say, to me, it smells like molasses. Like, I don't get smoky. Like, I've had smoky things where it kind of smells like barbecue.
Right, right.
It smells like molasses to me.
Okay, I'm going to let you taste it before I say anything. I don't want to ruin that initial experience for you.
Oh, my God, it really does.
It tastes like a campfire, y'all.
Are you trolling us with this beer, Chris?
No, I honestly not. It's the place that I typically buy from. It has a reasonable selection, but once you start to stray into international territory, the election gets narrower and narrower. And so I only had a couple to choose from. And I was like, well, this says Märzen on it, but it also, it has this weird smoke beer thing. And I've never heard of that before. And I was like, oh, let's have an experience. And boy, is it an experience.
It's exactly what you remembered, Carl.
It is exactly what I remembered. My impression is a little bit more positive now than it was the first time. What's interesting is you get the very initial time it touches your tongue, you get that malty molasses flavor that Amber was talking about, the smell. And then the aftertaste is pure smoke, man.
I've never in my life smoked a cigarette. Somehow I missed that in college. Not that I'm sad about it, but this is what I imagine a cigarette tastes like.
You know what? It's not wrong. I smoked for 20 years. I quit when my youngest daughter was born, a little bit after she was born, mostly because we had decided we were not going to smoke in the house anymore. She was born in June. I'm telling you, by December, we were done. We were like, because we'd go out outside and
outside in the snow,
freezing, and be like, I don't need this. I quit.
Nice.
Oh, man.
Would I be breaking the rules if I brought out a backup beer?
No.
You can bring out a backup beer. Our co-host, who's not here today, he always has a Diet Coke on his desk. He just uses that to chase the things that are not very good.
So here's kind of more along the lines. This is a Hocker Shore and it's Oktoberfest. I should have just said Oktoberfest to you guys.
I'm pretty sure I saw that exact label on the shelf when I was looking.
Because it says Oktoberfest Märzen on the label. And that's where that's an Oktoberfest. So they're kind of synonymous. They brew Oktoberfests in March.
Yeah. That was certainly an experience. I'm a thumbs down. I'm trying to think of like a food that would redeem this or something if you had it with something, but I can't think of anything. So I'm also a thumbs down.
All right. Well, we are really excited. Of course, you know, we talk beverages and it's fun. And this is like our Friday happy hour. But of course, we have you here to talk about accessibility. And I've been especially interested in hearing more about your new events platform, Eventably. So we're going to be talking about how you're reimagining event ticketing from an accessibility and maybe other perspectives as well. So I'm wondering, Carl, could you maybe start a little bit by sharing what your personal journey is that has brought you to Eventably and how you got here?
So I've told this story a couple of times, like conferences and stuff like that. But for some context, you know, on my background, like the web didn't exist when I graduated high school. It didn't even exist until I was, you know, almost out of college and stuff like that. So I came at this after the fact. You know, I grew up in a generation where everybody was like, you should learn about computers. You should learn about computers. And I played with a computer one winter when I was like 13. And then I was done with computers, man. That was it. I was more into skateboarding and cars and stuff like that. So fast forward to, you know, the mid 90s, and I was working in the music industry, and I worked as a talent agent, a talent buyer, which is the person who books shows at clubs, and a manager. And I managed a couple of punk rock bands. I was a talent agent for bands, and I booked well over a dozen, almost two dozen US tours for metal, hardcore, punk stuff. And that was at a time, if you guys remember, in the mid-90s, nationwide long-distance calling didn't exist. Like, you had to pay by the minute. And you were charged, I mean, if you got a really good deal, you were paying 5 cents a minute. Well, my job as a booking agent was dialing the phone. I was banging on the phone like 40 hours a week, calling clubs and stuff like that. And that was, you know, that was kind of an expensive kind of thing. And I started using email. I had my own talent agency. I worked in New York for a little bit, and then I left and worked for myself. And I had a kid, a college kid that I paid to be a web guy, and he made website stuff. And eventually I was like, I think I can do that stuff myself. So I started doing website updates and stuff like that. And I learned ASP Classic, you know, like classic ASP with Visual Basic, or I learned JSP and PHP and all that sort of stuff. One of the things I used to do is I used to require payments of 50% upfront. So let's say a band was guaranteed to get paid $5,000 for the night, I'd require a 50% deposit. So I learned the authorized.net gateway API and all, you know, that's how I got in all this stuff, was mostly that. And I was young, I was in my 20s at the time. And the thing about working in the music industry was really cool, because I'd make $1,000 a day, right? I mean, this was back in, like I said, in the 90s, $1,000 a day is pretty awesome. And then I would make nothing, like in the wintertime, right? Because your bands want to be, yeah. You know, your bands want to be on tour in the summer and not on the winter. And, you know, you got holidays and all that sort of stuff. Well, here I am, an immature kid, not knowing how to manage my money. It was like, you know, lots of money, no money, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I was looking, I was like, I should do something more consistent. Man, this web thing is pretty interesting. Now I'm in the DC area. And so now, for the trivia folks who are interested in accessibility, what happened in 1998 was Section 508 got passed, right? What happened in 2000, Section 508 became enforced. You know, there was that 2-year period from Section 508 coming out to Section 508 actually being quote unquote enforced. And so, similar to GDPR and similar to European Accessibility Act and all that, nobody cared about any of it until the enforcement period started, right? So fast forward, it's 2000 and I'm looking for a full-time job as a web developer in the DC area. And I'm applying at places like Northrop Grumman and Raytheon and what we call Beltway Bandits here in DC, which are government contractors. And I'm applying for jobs, and they're like, they would run my stuff through Bobby, which was the wave at the time, right? Bobby was a free online testing tool. And they'd be like, oh, we can't hire you. Your stuff's not accessible. We can't hire you. And after getting rejected a couple of times like that, I was like, well, F this. I'm just going to be the best that there is at this accessibility, whatever this accessibility thing is. You know, like I had no idea what it was. I was pretty active on Usenet news groups back then and read up on it. Lots of awesome people were there who are still in accessibility these days. Jez Lemon and Patrick Lauka over at Tetralogical, they were active on Usenet at the time. And so I was reading the stuff that they said, and I joined the WebAIM mailing list and all that, and really got exposed to it. And I was like, man, this actually does make sense. Like this accessibility stuff matters. You know what I mean? And for me, it became a kind of thing where it was like, okay, the quality of my work, how good of a job I do on this accessibility stuff impacts real people on the other side of the screen. And I thought that was really cool. And so that's how I really, you know, really got into accessibility, was because of that stuff. You know, it was really a cool idea. And really, I turned this thing that was keeping me from getting a job into a passion, because I thought it was really just, yeah, this makes sense.
And what kind of led you to eventually, once you got into accessibility, and then maybe making this a two-part question, can you segue into what Eventably is at a high level?
Yeah. Well, I'll answer the really high level first. Eventably is an events management and ticketing platform. So to continue the story, you know, I've worked as an accessibility consultant for a really long time. In 2014, I started working on Tenon. And Tenon was a testing tool that I felt was really badly needed in the space, because at that time, all the accessibility testing tools were tools that you had to use after the fact. In other words, you had to have a live web server, had to have a live website, et cetera. And so you're testing post-production code. And at that point, you know, the train has left the station on 1,001 different accessibility impacting decisions. And so I wanted a tool that could work for developers as the developers were working. So Tenon was an API-based accessibility testing tool, came out before Axe, before anything like that. And it was the first with a command line interface, the first with a grunt and gulp plugin, the first to work with Selenium, the first to have a WordPress plugin, first to have a Drupal plugin, et cetera. And it really sort of changed the game on how accessibility testing was done. I sold that company to Level Access in 2021, stayed around for a little while. And really, you know, really basically from the time that transaction was done, I was sort of thinking about, well, what else could I do? What could I do to disrupt things and make it more accessible? And I've always had ideas in my head around things that people can't do, you know, that they want to do in everyday life, the mainstream existence in the world. Because if you think about online meetings, you know what I mean? Online meetings for a very long time were terribly inaccessible. GoToMeeting and WebEx and all that stuff, they were horrible. Mm-hmm. Market pressures have improved them. Zoom came out. Zoom's been pretty good, you know, that sort of thing. It's not perfect, but it was pretty darn good. I knew that wasn't a space that I could compete in. Banking, obviously, I couldn't compete in. Shopping, you know, all that sort of stuff. There's all these things that I couldn't penetrate as a solo founder. But one thing that's always been stuck in the back of my mind is tickets to conferences. You know, I speak at conferences well over a dozen times a year on the average year. A lot of them are accessibility conferences. And at every one of them, somebody's complaining about what a pain in the butt it's been to buy tickets. And I thought, okay, I'm going to look into that, you know? Mm-hmm. And the other thing with Tenon was a passion project that sort of stumbled into success. I mean, as soon as Tenon was publicly available and the world knew about it, I was having conversations with Microsoft about, you know, about them using it. And it was just an accident, you know what I mean? Just built this thing I thought was cool. And then next thing you know, it's getting all this attention. But I didn't want to play my next startup by chance, you know? So I did a whole bunch of market research and looked into it. And I was like, oh yeah, this is a viable business thing. People.
What were you looking at when you were looking at market research to determine that something, that it was viable? And were you specifically saying you wanted to have another accessibility focused startup?
Yes, it was definitely 100% from the very beginning. I wanted to disrupt something from the accessibility perspective, because there's a couple of other things that I have aspirations for in terms of, I want to prove to all the naysayers, including accessibility naysayers, that complex software can be accessible. Lots of times you hear people say, well, it's a very complex thing. We can't make it really accessible. You know, they sort of throw in the towel before the conversation even begins. And then the other part is to prove that there's actual ROI to accessibility, that accessibility as a differentiator will make a business successful. So there's that sort of stuff. And of course, again, just proving that it can be done is a really big deal to me. And I don't want this to be a niche product. I want it to be a mainstream product that's accessible. And that's something that people tend to misunderstand when I talk to them about Eventably, is it's an accessible events ticketing platform. I should say probably that the other way around, and it's an events management and ticketing platform that is accessible. So in terms of the market research thing, we were looking at the number of events, the number of attendees, the average ticket price, et cetera, for mainstream stuff, not accessibility stuff. That being said, we do have some, I would say, talking points around accessibility. And what I mean by that is, we know that 80% of all people in the United States, all working adults in the United States, have attended at least one ticketed event in the last 12 months, at least one. Oh. Combine that with the fact that 20% of the population is disabled. If you do the math, 80% of 20% is 16%. And so, you know, if you think about, could you grow your business by 16%? Could you penetrate 16% more than you've already penetrated by being accessible? That's been the big question. And what we found is that it's true. Some more numbers. There was a survey done by a nonprofit in England that said 70% of disabled theatergoers would not go to an event if they didn't know what to expect when they got there. In other words, even if I could buy the ticket if I don't know what to expect because I have certain accessibility challenges, I'm not going to go. You know, is there accessible signage? You know, do they have elevators? Do they have escalators? Like some of these things you would normally think are obvious because they have to be there because of the ADA, but that's not entirely true, right?
If there's they don't lots of communicated on their website or something, then
yeah, like where's the entrance?
ADA compliant.
Yeah. And ADA compliance isn't always guaranteed for obvious reasons, but one of those reasons is if it's in an old building, right? An old building might not have a lot of needed accessibility stuff because it's old and its construction predates the ADA and those requirements and stuff like that. And if it hasn't been modified since, then the ADA stuff doesn't apply to them and et cetera, et cetera. So you think about that in major cities where, you know, the theater districts are in older parts of town or, you know, whatever the case may be, that's that part we're talking about, which is, I don't know what to expect when I get there. You know, what's the situation with assistance? Can I bring an assistant? Now, according to the ADA, the answer should always be yes, but that's not always the case, right? There's business owners who get salty about that sort of stuff. Again, where's the entrance? Where's the elevators? Where's the escalators? Where's, you know, the accessible bathrooms, the accessible seats? Do you have accessible seats? Again, the ADA says you're supposed to have a certain amount based upon the number of seats in the area. Right? Are those sold out? Or they, you know, how do I get to them? Who do I talk to? All these sorts of things. And so we're attacking accessibility sort of two ways. One is, of course, the platform itself. I won't name any names because I don't like bad mouthing competitors, but there are multiple competitors in the event space who have been sued. One of which only earlier this spring had just settled with the ACB or AFB, one of those, for inaccessibility. And multiple ones have also been sued in the past for that sort of stuff. And so the ticket buying experience, of course, is the first part. And there's another part which we call the disclosures, and that is that disclosure of that information. And so there's accessibility information for the event and accessibility information for the venue. And we provide the ability for people to disclose that too. And so that's kind of how we're tackling it. We obviously can't hold a gun to event organizers' heads and tell them they have to supply these things or any of that sort of stuff, but just providing that capability to the organizer to make that stuff known for the event attendee.
Yeah, if you give them the platform, right, that makes it a lot easier for them to comply with these requirements. So you mentioned two already, which was ticketing and disclosures. Are there other ways that Eventably is tackling the accessible event experience or anything else beyond those two things you can share?
We've had people ask us about consulting to help do the events themselves. And so we don't do that, but we have a small network of people that we trust who, if an organizer comes to us and says, hey, I want to do this stuff, I believe in this stuff, can you help me? We say no, but tell us a little bit about your event, and then we'll put you in touch with the right people to help you out with that sort of stuff.
That's awesome.
That's great. Yeah. I want to dive a little bit more into some of the common problems that maybe exist on event websites. But first, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back.
This episode of Accessibility Craft is sponsored by Equalized Digital Accessibility Checker, the WordPress plugin that helps you find accessibility problems before you hit publish. Thousands of businesses, nonprofits, universities, and government agencies around the world trust Accessibility Checker to help their teams find, fix, and prevent accessibility problems on an ongoing basis. New to accessibility? Equalized Digital Accessibility Checker is here to teach you every step of the way. Whether you're a content creator or a developer, our detailed documentation guides you through fixing accessibility issues. Never lose track of accessibility again with real-time scans each time you save, powerful reports inside the WordPress dashboard, and a front-end view to help you track down hard-to-find issues. Scan unlimited posts and pages with Accessibility Checker free. Upgrade to Accessibility Checker Pro to scan your website in bulk, whether it has 10 pages or 10,000. Download Accessibility Checker today at equalizeddigital.com/accessibility-checker. Use coupon code accessibilitycraft to save 10% on any plan.
So, of course, our podcast is all about digital accessibility. And I'm sort of curious, Are there common problems that you see on ticket selling websites that Eventively is solving, but also that you're like, man, how are they still making these mistakes in 2025?
You know, one of the things that a lot of people who might not know about accessibility miss out on is really how sometimes abysmal things can be from an accessibility perspective for people. It's job security for people like us, but it's not really a great experience sometimes for people, which is sort of the whole thing, like finding events, right? Getting access to the information about the events, determining if tickets are available, if they are available, knowing which ones are applicable for you, what they cost, adding those to your cart, the whole checkout process, all that sort of stuff, all of it is generally pretty bad. It gets even worse when you start diving into seating charts and virtual things, like virtual experience things. Now, in disclosure, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask you that. I was wondering that. Are you able to do in Eventably ticket or like seat picking off of a map?
Not yet. Both of those two things, the seat picking and the virtual event side of things, we're not able to do just yet. I have done all the UI work, and now there's a bunch of backend stuff that I have to deal with for the purchasing and inventory management and all that sort of stuff. That's a little bit heavy lift. But yeah, I mean, all that sort of stuff is really difficult for people to do. And it seems one of the hardest things we have to describing this to potential investors and things like that is that it's so hard to convey how inaccessible competing platforms are and how different and better we are when sort of things look the same and look like it works. I can check out, I can purchase the ticket. Like they don't really understand how a lot of those things that you all, and I'm sure your audience is well aware of, things like the labeling of controls and whether the controls work with a keyboard or not, and where focus goes as you're interacting with stuff, and all those sorts of things that require detailed forethought, design and development process that just don't make it in to those products, you know. And the more, as anybody who listens to this can probably attest, if they've got experience using stuff, is the more complex those interactions are, the more likely it is that there's going to be problems.
100%.
Yeah.
And you mentioned like investor conversations and kind of promoting Eventably to people before it was a fully fleshed out product. And I think that leads me, or I want to segue into the crowdfunding campaign that you all did. If you want to take us through like target timeline, how things changed over the campaign, if anything changed, and if there's anything you want to share with our audience that you learned from that process.
Yeah. So in the very, very early days, we did an Indiegogo campaign. And the Indiegogo campaign was similar to those that you would see for games and things like that. It was just an Indiegogo, you know, give us money because you think we're awesome and we'll give you some kickbacks and stuff like that. And that didn't go as well as I had hoped it would. I think there's two reasons for that. I think the part of it is just the accessibility community is smaller than the general tech community out there, and that's to be expected. One of the other ones was one of the feedbacks that we got was a lot of people going, well, what do I get out of it? You know, like a t-shirt or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the perks that we were offering, they weren't the same as you would get like with a game. If you're gonna contribute to a game, then that's gonna give you discounts for your game or whatever. And for me personally, I've personally contributed to the campaigns for physical hardware tech devices and things like that. And, you know, you get a discount on whatever the thing was. So I think our Indiegogo campaign was a little bit on the weak side anyway. So we only got about $6,500 out of that one. It was well spent for sure because we funded development. But now we're doing a WeFunder campaign now. And the difference is equity crowdfunding. Like it's equity funding there. It's actual investment. And I won't get into the geeky details, but this is covered under SEC regulations and all that sort of stuff. And it is actual equity in the company. And that's been a much more powerful message for a lot of people who, you know, believe in what we're doing and believe in the importance of it and stuff like that. But they also, you know, they want to get something out of it. And they're actually getting part of the company, right? They're getting actual equity. And so that's been pretty successful. It's a little bit slower, of course, than I want it to be, but we're at 65,000 now.
Hey.
Great. And again, it's and what people get out of it, of course, like I said, is they get early equity access to the company, actual ownership, and they get a discount on future purchases of equity later on down the road. If we do another investment round, they get a discount on those shares as well. And so that's been really cool. And I'm a big fan of what we're doing with that because I want the community to be part of it, right? Like I could go to angel investors and pitch meetings and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like I could totally do that. I have one of my co-founders is a CRO. He went to Wharton Business School and Yale. This guy's got an MBA. He's great at that sort of stuff. But my thing is I really do want people, especially people in the disability community and the accessibility field, to actually have ownership in this. That's a big passion for me is that, you know, there's always that saying in the disability world, nothing about us without us. Bang, here you go. Be an owner.
Yeah.
That is really interesting. You'll have to give us the link and we can put it in the show notes for people who want to check that out. We did a lot of fundraising conversations, and then we did bring in an angel investor for Equalize Digital a couple of years ago. And I explored some of the like equity crowdfunding platforms, but I was always like, just because I was trying to think, you know, how much effort am I going to have to put into building this? That's the weird thing about crowdfunding is you really have to get people excited about what the product is. And you have to do a lot of social pushes and you have to like all these videos and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm curious, I don't know, like, maybe it's a little bit more positive when people are able to do more of the equity investment than just like the regular crowdfunding. But do you feel like there's enough public interest in accessibility to actually support that? That's what I was nervous about. And then I ended up being like, I feel like I'm going to put so much effort in, it's not going to do anything. So we decided not to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a harder slog too, right? Because you know, with an angel investor, they're writing a $100,000 check and you're done. You know, you got like $100,000 in your pocket. Whereas with us, a lot of our investors
$10, $50.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, I don't think we've got anything less than 100. And most of them are at $5,000. A large portion of them are about $5,000 a piece, which is great, but it's still a harder slog. Getting there at $5,000 a piece to something big is pretty hard. And so that's, you know, it is a concern. Like you said, is the accessibility community big enough for that? And I don't know. I really don't know. I guess we're going to find out maybe the hard way. But I think about the potential return for this sort of thing and how much money is in the ticketing events platform space. If you look at, so there's a number that a lot of investors look for, which is called a TAM. You guys probably know what that is. But a TAM, for anybody who doesn't know, is the total addressable market. That's the total number of people multiplied by the amount average spent for whatever the thing is. So if it's, let's say it's an iPhone, what's the TAM on an iPhone? It's how many people pay $1,000 for a phone across the planet. So for us, the TAM for just conferences, conventions, and trade shows, we're leaving sports and live music out, just conferences, conventions, and trade shows, is $20 billion. If we start counting live music, and you got to dial it in a little bit because it's not like I'm going to compete with Ticketmaster and stadiums or anything like that. But like rock clubs, you know, like rock clubs that don't have seating, comedy clubs, things like that. If you start throwing that in there, now that TAM gets huge. You know, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And so that's what I hope is going to resonate to people who, again, want to prove that there's ROI and accessibility is that, yes, the market is there. The market is huge. There's a lot of competition out there, but that just the existence of competition also means there's a market. You know what I mean? It's proving product market fit by the fact that there's so many other companies that do exactly what we're doing in a less accessible way. And we're hoping that we can grow the market by 16%. I mean, our thesis is that we're bringing 492 million people into this market worldwide.
Who were previously locked out of it because of a lack of features and information.
Yes,
that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So It did not escape our notice that Eventably is built on WordPress CMS. And as our audience knows, and as you might know, we're pretty big fans of WordPress. Yeah. So I'm curious if you considered other content management systems and what ultimately made you go with WordPress if you considered multiple.
You know, I mean, for me, the options were WordPress or WordPress. Because, and the number one reason for it is the accessibility aspect to it. And then the second one was the fact that there would be non-technical people updating content. Those are the two really big factors. Because if it was just going to, let's say it was just going to be me or something like that, then I could have used some, you know, headless CMS or I could have used some static web builders and things like that based on, you know, templating engines or whatever, and just maintain the content out of markdown files and be done with it, you know what I mean? But that's a really geeky approach to doing that sort of stuff. And it wasn't really a worthwhile exploration for me because I know somebody else is going to have to manage the content on the site. And that means you need a robust content management system. And the reason why we didn't do anything else was WordPress gives us the ability to have full control over the UI, you know, subject, of course, to intelligently choosing whatever plugins we use. The theme is entirely ours. The block editor provides us everything we need to do to customize different pieces of information that we need, that sort of stuff. And so it was really kind of a no-brainer at that point, is to use WordPress for that stuff. My personal website is WordPress, so...
Yeah. Yeah, if that's what you know, it really makes sense. Like, I have a hard time envisioning if I would ever build a website that was not a WordPress website. I'm curious, are there any accessibility considerations that you're putting in specifically for the website itself and those content creators, and like any sort of training that you're doing with them? Or did you hire a whole team that already knew accessibility?
So the design itself, because I'm not a good designer and none of the other people on the founding team are good designers either. The design itself was more of a collaborative effort of us on the founding team sort of outlining what we wanted and then coming in through there with myself and John, which is he's one of the co-founders, and John has worked with me at Tenon and works with me at Afix as well, sort of outlined some of the accessibility parameters for the design. And then we hired somebody to do the UI design in Figma. We dialed that in with the colors and the font choices and all that sort of stuff. And then we did the implementation. So it was a lot of, I guess, something I alluded to a moment ago, which is like just forethought about what is an accessible outcome look like on this design and what are the things we need to worry about with respect to the colors, the control types when we were implementing this, what, you know, if something looks like a button, does it operate like a button, all that sort of stuff. And then, of course, responsive design, what the reflow looks like and all that sort of stuff. But these were all things that we gave forethought to before the implementation. So, for instance, we didn't just have our designer work on the UI design for the desktop layout, but also, hey, what does this look like when it reflows to mobile? And so our Figma designs have the mobile, the desktop, the tablet, and the mobile views and the breakpoints defined and all that sort of stuff. And I find that when you put the forethought into what you're doing, it makes it go way more smoothly when you're actually doing the implementation.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So I've got a two-parter to kind of wrap us up. So this is kind of your invitation, I guess, to share anything else you want our audience to know about Eventably or anyone who's listening to or watching this. And also work in there, please, where people can go to learn more about the project.
Yeah. So the project right now, we're in a good space with the project being able to handle all of the, I would say, bulk of the base functionality that you want out of an events management and ticketing platform. Defining your schedule, managing your presenters, managing your venues, having multiple venues, multiple ticket types, ticket discounts, free tickets, donation tickets, donations that are separate from a ticket, extra activities, all that sort of stuff. These are all things that are there and baked in. And if you're used to using something like an Eventbrite or something like that, give us a try and see. We are obviously a new product and we're growing. So there are things like we mentioned before that are like assigned seating and virtual events and all that sort of stuff that we're not really doing yet. But we'd like to see people give us a try The product is free for all free events. So if you have a meetup, if you have a bar camp or anything like that, you just use it for free now. And then for paid events, our pricing is pretty darn good. It's about the same as what you'll expect elsewhere. It's $1 per ticket plus 3% and plus the processing fee. So we think it's an economical thing. And the other thing we have to offer that is really, I think, a game changer is white glove support, meaning we will actually manage the events for you online. Obviously, the goal is for people to be self-sufficient in managing it themselves, but we're not going to sit there and expect you to be an expert user and all that sort of stuff. You know, so it's not like an Eventbrite or any of these others that are out there and they're like, here you go, sign up and get started. We will walk you through the entire process from beginning to end to make sure it's successful. The other part about that, as you guys know, as people who make products, is it gives us massively valuable information about where we can improve.
Oh yeah. You know, we have these onboarding calls that we include with our small business and above tier of Accessibility Checker. And it's a call with either me or Chris. And it is the best use of my 30 minutes.
Yes.
Anytime absolutely. I do that, I'm always like, it's so, especially in WordPress land, which, you know, like every WordPress website looks so different. And there's no way we could ever test our software on every possible yeah. theme and plugin combination. And so this allows us to literally see what it looks like yeah. in all these different combinations.
And I think people have a hard time believing me when I say this, but my favorite customers are complainers, right? Because,
oh, really?
Because if somebody complains, it means they care enough to tell you how they feel. And they're going to probably tell you about something that 10 other people thought about and didn't say. So, because that's the worst part, is hearing later on down the road, oh, I couldn't use the accessibility checker because whatever. And then it's like a legitimate concern. And you're like, man, I should have fixed that. You know what I mean? And
that's, I would have fixed it if I'd known, right?
If I would have fixed it if I had known. Yeah. So yeah. I love it when people complain, man. I mean, obviously I want them to do it nicely, but frankly speaking, as long as it gives me an opportunity to improve, that's all I care about. And people think you're crazy when you say that, but I'm like, no, complain. Like, we have the little chat guy on the bottom right corner, click that thing and yell at us. You know what I mean? Cause that gives us an opportunity to know something's wrong and figure out something that we need to fix. So to that end, people can just come to the site, sign up at eventibly.com. And that gives you the ability to start organizing an event. And yeah, anytime anybody has any questions, just fire up the chat or send us an email or whatever. Email me. I'm super easy to find for sure. And we want to help people, you know, become successful on it.
Well, you heard it here, everybody. Carl wants your complaints about Eventibly.
Yeah.
Go use it. Go try it out. It's a super interesting project, and we're glad to support it in some small way by getting it out to people. And it's super important that there are more sectors and industries that have accessible disruptors in them. So kudos to you and your team for doing the hard work.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on. I am sorry about this beer. I tried later on to take one sip. People who are watching will have seen me try to give it another sip.
Yeah.
And I was trying. It was when you were talking about how awesome WordPress was, and I was trying not to make a gross face. But I was like, maybe it'll have, you know, gotten better as it breathed a little. But
no, now it's warmer even. And now you're like, the smoke is even worse when it's warm.
Yep. Well, we'll have you back on again in the future to have a tastier beer and give us an update on this. So thanks so much, Carl.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Accessibility Craft. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcast app to get notified when future episodes release. You can find Accessibility Craft on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And if building accessibility awareness is important to you, please consider rating Accessibility Craft 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Accessibility Craft is produced by Equalize Digital and hosted by Amber Hines, Chris Hines, and Steve Jones. Steve Jones composed our theme music. Learn how we help make thousands of WordPress websites more accessible at equalizedigital.com.